The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Gorgeous day here at Edstone. Nice and sunny outside, 51, 52 degrees, I believe it is. Although I think we have more cold weather coming in this next weekend, so winter may not be over just yet. But we have moved our clocks forward, and we made good use of our extra hour today with preparation, although still I could have used another hour, maybe last week was rubbing off on me. Lots of clips, so many that I don't think we'll be able to get to all of them today. But it is, going back to just how beautiful it is outside, it's a beautiful time of year to come into the spring months now and to see the beautiful landscape around Edstone in all of its brilliant color. Well, on today's show, coming up in the next segment, we're going to be talking about another important anniversary, and it's quite an inspiring story. You'll want to stay tuned for that. We'll also draw attention to one of our booklets. I think one of them that maybe doesn't get quite enough attention. I went through it this morning, and it's definitely one that I'd like to do a television program on soon as well. So we'll spend some time on that coming up in the next segment after we run through a few of the headlines from the last few days, from over the weekend. On Saturday, of course, in Washington, D.C., we had the March for Our Lives, the big protest movement. All of these young people, I didn't do enough reading on it to get an estimate for how many were there, but just judging by the pictures, quite a few young people turned up in D.C. To listen to some of these speakers that you've been seeing on CNN and MSNBC and even Fox News. David Hogg is probably the one. He's 17 from South Florida. He's probably one that has gotten the most attention. And here he is in his speech there at the start talking about Marco Rubio, as if he's the one who killed all of those students in the Parkland School a few weeks back. Clip 15.
First off, I'm going to start off by putting this price tag right here as a reminder for you guys to know how much Marco Rubio took for every student's life in Florida. $1.05. Okay. The cold grasp of corruption shackles the District of Columbia. The winter is over. Change is here. The sun shines on a new day.
And so there's David Hogg blaming Marco Rubio, the NRA, talking about change sweeping across the nation because of these young people. And one thing, we haven't pointed this out enough. I came across this story, or I guess Sam did a few weeks back, and we didn't go through it much. We've definitely drawn attention to the Isaiah 3 prophecy, children rising up, basically, and fathers aren't mentioned. So that certainly, that you're seeing that fulfilled for sure. But at the same time, we should also note that this kind of gathering, Sam tells me it was maybe an estimated 500,000 people showed up. So that's a lot of people showing up for March for Our Lives. But it's important to note that this is not some kind of spontaneous reaction from young people all across the nation. This is being organized. This is sponsored by the radical left. This story I'm talking about, it was at the Federalist 3 or 4 weeks ago, where this author is talking about the immediate reaction that the mainstream media had, that the press had, once that tragedy happened and those young people were killed at that high school. Then the young people who survived that tragedy jumped in front of the cameras, and of course, all of those in the media heaped praise upon them, saying, "Wow, they're really mobilizing all of them," and some of them are quite eloquent. Can you believe these kids? It's been a recurring theme of the coverage of the Parkland school shooting, this author writes at The Federalist. The remarkable effectiveness of the high school students who created a gun control organization in the wake of the massacre. In seemingly no time, the Magical Kids had organized events ranging from a national march to a mass school walkout. So we've seen the school walkout, and now you have the national march. Took place on Saturday, the March for Our Lives. All of this money started pouring in from Oprah Winfrey and George Clooney. This author says here that the Miami Herald, one of the papers in Florida, credited the success of these young people rising together with one voice, we're told, to the school's stellar debate program. I mean, they're educated. They're smart. They've been through debate class. The Wall Street Journal said it's because they were born online and organizing was instinctive. They just know how to do it. You see, the little post on Facebook and everyone shows up. That's all there is to it. It says here, on February 28th, so this is going back a month ago now, BuzzFeed came out with the actual story. Okay, so here's what actually happened. Representative Debbie Wasserman Schultz, aiding in the lobbying in Tallahassee, a teachers union organizing the buses that got the kids there, Michael Bloomberg's groups, and the Women's March working on the upcoming March for Our Lives. So this is several weeks ago. Now we've seen the march, 500,000 people. It says moveon.org doing social media promotion and potentially march logistics and training for student activists provided by federally funded Planned Parenthood. I mean, the students aren't just actors, as some were saying, some from the conservative side several weeks ago. But they're hardly without some significant sponsorship and support and help when it comes to organizing these kinds of events. It says the president of the American Federation of Teachers told BuzzFeed they're also behind the national school walkout, which journalists had previously assured the public was the sole work of a teenager. It's just the teens. And you may have seen some stories where other teenagers have said, well, hey, I'm gonna walk out spontaneously to protest against abortion. Let's see how that flies. Not as well received as the walkout protesting gun violence or calling for gun control. The reason why you saw that happen, seemingly in a spontaneous manner, from coast to coast across the United States, is because you have organizations like the American Federation of Teachers behind it, okay? In other words, the response was professionalized. The Federalist says here, that's not surprising because this is what organization that gets results actually looks like. It's not a bunch of magical kids in somebody's living room. Nor is it surprising that the professionalization happened right off the bat. It says further on, talks about just how some of these left-wing organizers in southern Florida were friends with David Hogg's families, or his family, sorry. And so they saw this as an opportunity. We've had this mass shooting. We're all proponents of gun control. Our children have gone through this tragedy. They're angry. They're upset. The Federalist says, what's striking about all of this isn't the organization. If you start reading books about organizing, it's clear how it all works. But no journalist covering the story wrote about this stuff for 2 weeks. And I would submit to you that really they're still not writing about it. I mean, he gives credit to BuzzFeed a month ago, talking about the real story behind these marches, these movements. And did you hear or read anything on that this past weekend? Here are the organizations that are sponsoring it, that are organizing it, that make it professionalized. Journalists aren't covering it. They're not really covering it on the right either. He says, on Twitter, I lost track of the number of blue checks rhapsodizing over how effective the kids' organizational instincts are. It says, but organizing isn't instinctive. It's skilled work. You have to learn how to do it. And it takes a lot of people. He says, finally, this is from the Federalist from March 1st. The real tip-off should have been the $500,000 donations from Oprah Winfrey and George Clooney. Big celebrities don't give huge money to strangers on a whim. You think those celebrities are just going to throw around $500,000 to a disorganized lot of 15-year-olds? They knew where the money was going. They made the donation because they knew there were lots of institutions and organizations behind it, like Women's March, like Michael Bloomberg's groups, like MoveOn.org, like this most recent one, March for Our Lives, again. The front, with all these radical left-wing organizations working behind the scenes. And for weeks and weeks and weeks, here it is again, journalists failing in their responsibility to tell us the real story, to tell us what's going on, to tell us that this is not just teenagers who are upset that we don't have more gun control. This is a far-left political wing, a far-left political movement. And like this article brings out, it's not like it's just the mainstream that's not telling this story. There's a lot of outlets on the right who are also, I mean, I think it was David Hogg and someone else on Chris Wallace's show yesterday morning on Fox. You might see a few stories on Fox and a few conservative sites about, you know, the teen that's speaking up and saying, you know, we have Second Amendment rights. And I can't believe they're not talking more about the breakdown in law enforcement from every level. Well, we've talked about that on this program. And at least there's one or two teens from that school who are speaking up, but they don't get as much coverage, not near as much, as David Hogg and his friends. So yes, it is Isaiah 3. It shows how upside down our society is. But it also shows what kind of influence and even control the radical left still has on the major media and on education and on so many of our young people. And so it's Isaiah 3. It's also America Under Attack, or the more recent Great Again, which talks a lot about the influence coming from the far left as well. Well, just to follow up on what we discussed Friday, this budget buster, $1.3 trillion. The Atlantic said that President Obama finally got a Republican-controlled Congress to fund his domestic budget. President Obama, not President Trump, President Obama, he finally got a Republican-controlled Congress to fund his domestic budget. All it took was Donald Trump in the White House to get it done. Trump moves in, and then, all of course, the Republicans there in the House and in the Senate, they say, hey, let's spend away. Let's give every program what it wants and more, and not even think twice about it, because now we've got our president in the White House. So we can show the world we're just as big in spending as the left-wing Democrats are. Well, as we suggested on Friday morning show, this was before President Trump signed it into law. That happened later on in the day. He made some comments, I guess, on Twitter suggesting that it might be a bill that he would veto. But he didn't. In the end, he signed it into law. And judging by his comments at a press conference Friday, he sounded reluctant. But nevertheless, it goes forward. Here's what he had to say on Friday, clip 14.
I've signed this omnibus budget bill. There are a lot of things that I'm unhappy about in this bill. There are a lot of things that we shouldn't have had in this bill, but we were, in a sense, forced, if we want to build our military, we were forced to have. There are some things that we should have in the bill. But I say to Congress, I will never sign another bill like this again. I'm not going to do it again. Nobody read it. It's only hours old. Some people don't even know what it is.
Well, that's President Trump from Friday, admitting that no one could have possibly read it, or at least all of it, because they didn't have time. I think the House voted on it something like 16, 17 hours after they released it Wednesday night. And then the Senate followed suit 6 or 7 hours after that. $1.3 trillion in spending. I'm never going to do it again, but how many times have we heard this from the White House and from Congress? This is it. This is the last one. We're not going, from now on, we're going to control spending. From now on, we're going to stay within budget. That article at The Atlantic, it says, in the $1.3 trillion spending bill that President Trump reluctantly signed on Friday, lawmakers did more than reject the steep cuts in dollars and programs that Trump proposed for domestic agencies a year ago. Across much of the government, Republican leaders agreed to spending levels that matched or even exceeded what Obama asked Congress to appropriate in his final budget request in 2016. So they turned it down. They denied Obama's request just a year and a half ago, or 2 years ago, it says, and many of which lawmakers ignored while he was in office. So, well, a lot of Americans are quite angry, very angry, even some of Trump's staunchest supporters, I should say. They're upset. This was the sort of thing he vowed to get in and correct or straighten out. He was going to drain the swamp. And he said last year, there's a lot of programs that we've got to cut, that we've got to get rid of. Well, it didn't happen. As I said on Friday, I mean, even Planned Parenthood, fully funded. Never mind all the promises that Republicans made. It says at the Washington Free Beacon that we'll just continue right on. American taxpayers paying millions and millions of dollars despite the many pledges, promises, vows that Republicans made to defund the nation's largest abortion organization. Planned Parenthood gets about $540 million a year, like $500 million a year from American taxpayers. And it performs hundreds of thousands of abortions every year. And so Republicans, they campaign on this because they have such widespread support in conservative circles. They say every time there's a campaign, we're going to defund it. We're not going to pay for this. It's not right. And yet the $1.3 trillion so-called omnibus spending bill on Friday, it's going to send another $543 million to Planned Parenthood. That's $543 million paid by the U.S. taxpayer. 40% of Planned Parenthood's revenue comes from U.S. taxpayers. It comes from taxes that Americans pay. Well, it quotes this conservative at the end saying it's hard for the pro-life base to look at a bill like the omnibus that fully funds Planned Parenthood and is chock full of other broken promises and not come away completely disgusted with the Republican Party. Lots and lots of people just thoroughly disgusted with what Republicans are doing in Washington. Another story here from Bret Stephens. He took a break from some of his President Trump bashing. It's almost hard to read him anymore. He used to be one of my favorite writers, but it seems that's all he's really concerned about anymore. But in this particular piece at the New York Times, he exposes the truth about the United Nations. This is following the appointment that the president made at the end of last week of John Bolton, who used to work at the United Nations. Now he's going to be the top security advisor for the president, pretty good pick. He's one that I actually patted on the back in Herzliya, Israel. I'm sure he wouldn't remember me, but he was a friendly chap at this security conference that a number of us were attending. He was one of the featured speakers, and now he's right there advising the president. Well, he said several years ago that if the United Nations lost 10 stories, it wouldn't make a bit of difference. You could go blow up part of the UN building in New York, and it really would matter very little to the affairs of this world. And Bret Stephens says, you know, people keep pointing back to that statement, and he's sitting here wondering why it's even controversial. I mean, look at the UN. Look at this this organization, this international body. Stephen says the UN is a never-ending scandal disguised as an everlasting hope. The hope is that dialogue can overcome distrust and collective security can be made to work in the interests of humanity. Reality, though, says otherwise. I mean, just look at the world, and that's what he does here. It's an excellent piece. Look at the world. I mean, where do you start when you talk about UN scandals? Where do you start? It says UN peacekeepers caused a cholera epidemic in Haiti that so far has taken 10,000 lives. Yet it took the UN headquarters 6 years to acknowledge responsibility. An AP investigation found nearly 2,000 allegations of sexual abuse and exploitation by peacekeepers and other personnel around the world over a 12-year period, including 300 allegations involving children. These are UN peacekeepers in Haiti sexually abusing children. 2,000 allegations of sexual abuse, and only a fraction of the alleged perpetrators have served any kind of jail time. It says here, in Rwanda in 1994, UN peacekeepers all but abandoned the country at the outset of genocide that took at least 500,000 lives. Stephen says, and then there are comparatively lesser scandals. Well, he rattles off a number of those from around the world as well. Further on, he says, the UN adopted what were supposed to be landmark reforms from more than a decade ago, yet the mismanagement, corruption, abuses, and moral perversities remain. Iran sits on the executive board of the Commission on the Status of Women. Iran. They're on the executive. This is at the UN. They're on the executive board of the Commission on the Status of Women. The Syrian regime is represented on the UN Special Committee on Decolonization, dedicated to respect for self-determination of all peoples. The Syrian regime. So is it surprising? Is it controversial for John Bolton to say if it lost 10 stories, it wouldn't make any difference, the UN building? It says, and this is Bret Stephens talking about the UN today. It says, in October, Zimbabwe's Robert Mugabe was named as a goodwill ambassador by the World Health Organization until an outcry forced the director general to think better of it. Let's put Robert Mugabe there. Yeah, that makes good sense. It says, finally, imagine if the UN was going to the United States and raping children and bringing cholera. A Haitian lawyer seeking compensation for the UN's victims told the AP, human rights aren't just for rich white people. Stephen says that point ought to resonate with the UN's usual defenders, whose idealism rarely seems dented and only occasionally informed by experience. Look at what they're doing in Haiti, or what they've done in places like Rwanda. That's the United Nations. That's, if we listen to the opening comments following the charter in 1945, this is our last best hope, the UN. Well, we're going to talk more coming up in the next segment about peace and man's efforts to obtain peace on this world. Go ahead and put it back up there, Sam. The last thing I'll just touch on here, we'll be commenting on this, by the way, in today's Trumpet Brief, these coins that have been discovered in, the dig that some of our students are involved in. They're coming up to the end of their phase of digging here in just the next few days. And I believe there's an English-translated press release coming out today about these coins, and we're going to try to write something up real soon. I haven't even read the press release yet myself, but we're going to try to write something on this as soon as possible for the Trumpet magazine, and also, as I say, touch on it on today's Trumpet Brief. If you haven't subscribed to the Trumpet Brief, you can get that daily email blast right into your inbox and get, as in the case of today's, you can get some breaking news. You can subscribe to that at our website, thetrumpet.com. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments through to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
We desperately need peace. When you look around and see what's happening in this world, Mr. Armstrong attended the UN conference in San Francisco in 1945, and they were establishing a UN charter, and said that this was the last hope that man had for peace. This was their last hope. Well, Mr. Armstrong happened to be there, and he interviewed some people. He was working as a reporter for his magazine, and he said he'd never seen such savage infighting in all of his life. So you wouldn't expect they're going to bring peace out of something like that, would you? And if you look at where they are today, you know they haven't brought any peace to this world. And that's our last hope?
That's from my father's Key of David program. February 2012, and he was commenting there on Herbert Armstrong attending that first UN conference in San Francisco in 1945. And Mr. Armstrong in 1945 witnessed the savage infighting. And now we're here in 2018. We can look at the track record. We can look back at what's happened since 1945. We can look at what the United Nations is doing to little nations like Haiti. Is this our last hope? Has that organization brought peace to this world, anywhere in this world? Has it really brought peace? Well, we're going to talk today, in the time that we have left, about the way to peace. We probably don't give it nearly the attention that we should. But there's a wonderful little booklet that, as I said earlier, I hope to offer on television real soon. We produced it back in 2012, the same year as that program, the clip I just played for you. So it's about 6 years old, and it's titled The Way of Peace Restored Momentarily. And this happens to be an excellent day to spotlight the message in that booklet. Because it was on this day, 39 years ago, that Egyptian President Anwar Sadat and Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin signed a treaty of mutual recognition and peace. And that peace treaty ended 30 years of warfare between Egypt and Israel. Today's the 39-year anniversary. I thought about holding off on this material until next year, the nice, neat and tidy 40-year anniversary. But the message of this inspiring little booklet, it's too good to put off for another year. March 26th, 1979, Egyptian President Anwar Sadat and Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin, they signed the Israel-Egypt Peace Treaty in Washington, D.C., along with Jimmy Carter, the President of the United States at that time. I read through the, as I say, the Way of Peace Restored momentarily this morning, and after reading it, and then just doing some of the research with Sam for this segment, you read the Way of Peace Restored momentarily, and you read, and then you read about that that signing ceremony on March 26, 39 years ago. And really, really, Herbert W. Armstrong should have been at that ceremony. He should have been there. He had a lot to do with it. The peace that you saw there between Egypt and Israel. Let's start with President Sadat. He was there. I don't know if this comment was right before they signed the documents or right after, but it's from this day 39 years ago. Here's what Egyptian President Anwar Sadat had to say. This is clip one.
This is certainly one of the happiest moments in my life. It is a historic turning point of great significance for all peace-loving nations, those among us who are endowed with vision cannot fail to comprehend the dimensions of our sacred mission. The Egyptian people, with their heritage and unique awareness of history, have realized from the very beginning the meaning and value of this endeavor. In all the steps I took, I was not performing a personal mission. I was merely expressing the will of a nation. I'm proud of my people and of belonging to them.
That's President Sadat of Egypt from March 26, 1979, talking about how happy he was to sign this peace agreement. What a historic day. I mean, this was a real turning point, the way he saw it, and it was. It was the fruit show. I mean, again, if you know a little bit about the history leading up to that day, and then when you consider the peace that followed that ceremony, the peace between Egypt and Israel, then it truly was a significant day. In his book, Israel, A History, Martin Gilbert, he says, no war in the past had ever been launched against Israel without Egypt being the leader, and then the other Arab states following. So for 30 years, Egypt had taken the lead in fighting Israel. Gilbert says no war against Israel had ever ended without Egypt being the first to pull out, and then the others following. For 30 years, leading the Arab world to fight against Israel, or to surrender, if that's what Egypt chose to do. Egypt was the regional power, if you leave aside Israel. Israel was the enemy, the way Egypt and so many of Israel's neighbors saw it. But here was Anwar Sadat, and through that time, when Egypt was fighting Israel, when Egypt was attacking Israel, when Egypt had led the way to attack Israel just 6 years before this signing ceremony, the Yom Kippur War. And now all of a sudden he's in Washington, D.C. March 26, 1979, talking about this being one of the most happiest moments of his life. What happened? What changed in Sadat's mind? Why did he reach out to Israel? He did all of this because he wanted peace. He was pursuing peace. For decades, he had pursued war. For decades, he had tried to destroy Israel. And now he wanted to change course. Now he wanted to stop. He wanted to stop fighting and to start making peace. And he was the one, more than any other, well, at least on the national level, like my father's booklet brings out, when you bring the spiritual dimension into it, you have to give a lot of the credit to Herbert Armstrong. But on the national level, he's the one that really took the lead, just like he had for so many years with leading in war. Here he took the lead to reach out to Israel for peace. Gilbert, in his book, he talks about how, Jimmy Carter, the U.S. president, he wasn't one of America's strongest presidents, for sure, but he was trying to get in there and help, and he was frustrated because he couldn't make enough progress. It wasn't until Sadat took charge and changed himself, his own thinking. Martin Gilbert says here, Sadat extricated himself from the possibility of American and Soviet pressure by taking the bull by the horns, as one Israeli diplomat expressed it, and deciding to take a direct and separate initiative of his own to a visit to Jerusalem. This was something he decided on his own. The United States wasn't making the progress that it wanted to make. All sides were frustrated. So it was Anwar Sadat who took the lead. He wasn't going to sit back and wait for America to finalize this or to make this happen. So he reached out in November of 1977. I mean, and just to give you some context of what was happening at the time, on November 6th, 1977, members of the PLO had fired rockets from Lebanon into Israel, killing an Israeli woman. And then the following day, Israel launched their retaliatory attacks. Here's what Gilbert had to say in his book. Later that day, President Sadat, in a speech at the opening of the Egyptian parliament, said that he wanted to address members of the Knesset in Jerusalem. And this is a direct quote from Sadat. It says, "I'm willing to go to the ends of the earth for peace. Israel will be astonished to hear me say now, before you, that I am prepared to go to their own house, to the Knesset itself, to talk to them." How did many in Israel respond to that? They didn't believe him. They didn't believe him. He can't be serious. He's been attacking us all these years. We're still being attacked. Gilbert says that Israel was in a turmoil of anticipation and disbelief. BBC had this to say. I don't think this was at the time, but this is from their history on this event. It says, the Egyptian leader's offer in a speech to his parliament on November 9th, that would have been 1977, to travel to Israel was widely regarded as no more than a literary flourish. Nobody took him seriously. Nobody believed him. I mean, this kind of thing just doesn't happen. It says, when Prime Minister Begin responded by issuing an official invitation, nobody believed Mr. Sadat would accept. His presence in Israel breaks an Arab policy of not dealing publicly with the Jewish state. This is a policy that was created in 1948, when the Israeli state was established. So for 30 years, it was an established policy in the Arab world. Do not deal publicly with the Jewish state. Well, he made that announcement at his own parliament, November 9th, 1977, and it wasn't but 10 days later, November 19th, 1977, that Anwar Sadat made his historic visit to Jerusalem. He followed through, and Israel welcomed him, as you can hear there. I mean, this was an event. This was something no one ever thought would happen. On the anniversary of Sadat's visit in 2017, the Times of Israel had this to say. This is from last year on March 26th. It says, Sadat became the first and so far only Arab leader to visit Israel and address the Knesset with a call for peace. It had never happened before, and it has never happened since. And going back to those comments that Sadat made in 1979 on the White House lawn, think of the significance of this peace initiative, this effort for peace. The late Yitzhak Rabin, he's the former prime minister of Israel, he happened to meet with Sadat on that particular visit in 1977. And he wrote that this was the first time I had ever seen him in the flesh, and I was enormously impressed by the poise with which he handled himself in such a unique situation. Here he was meeting all his former arch enemies, one after another, in the space of seconds, and he nonetheless found a way to start off his visit by saying exactly the right thing to each and every one of them. I mean, what a remarkable turnaround, in other words. What an absolute shock. He wanted to wipe Israel off the map. And now he said exactly the right things. The Israelis were impressed. Martin Gilbert says the American government's immediate reaction to the Sadat visit was surprise, bewilderment, and even apprehension that Israel and Egypt might cut a deal and leave American interests stranded. I mean, Sadat just forged ahead really without America. And America hopped back on board at the end. Says Secretary of State Cyrus Vance made a rapid visit to both Jerusalem and Cairo, where he was given assurance that close American participation in the process would be welcomed. America didn't want to be left out in the cold. I mean, this was a diplomatic triumph. And America, the Carter administration wanted some of the credit. You can see why. This was historic. This was unprecedented. Well, it says here on the 4th of September, 1978, that's when the meetings began at Camp David. So you had the Camp David Accords in late 1978. Well, you had the visit, Sadat's visit to Israel in late 1977, the Camp David Accords the following year, and then that brings you to this particular anniversary, March 26th, 1979. But before I get to that, let me just back up to those Camp David Accords. It says the Israeli participants who gathered on September 4th, headed by Menachem Begin, including the Foreign Minister Moshe Dayan and the Minister of Defense, Yisr Weizmann, it says throughout the discussions, President Carter served as mediator. President Sadat was there. The leaders of other Arab countries, listen to this. The leaders of other Arab countries, Jordan, Syria, Saudi Arabia, as well as the Palestinians, refused to join him. But Sadat persevered. Whatever agreement he could reach, he would present as one that had been reached on behalf of the absentees as well. That's from Martin Gilbert's take, his history. Sadat went alone. He was all by himself. The established policy for the other Arab nations, as I said, it was look, you don't talk to Jews, certainly not in public. What a change in heart this world leader had back in 1977. Herbert Armstrong spoke about that in a sermon, or I think a radio show, I forget which, that he gave many years ago. Here's clip three.
It happened on November 20th, 1977. President Sadat declared not war, he declared peace on Israel. He braved a personal visit to Jerusalem to speak before the Knesset in Jerusalem. Now, I want you to consider his position. Egypt was then the leader in the Arab world, and Sadat was the leader in Egypt. The Arab Union had its headquarters in Cairo. He was the leader of the whole Arab world. He risked all of that and the irate hostility of the whole Arab world in going on a mission to peace to speak to the Knesset in Jerusalem of the nation of Israel. It took vision, it took courage, it took, let me say it, guts. It really did. And it took great risk, risk to his own person and risk to his political position.
Now, Mr. Armstrong had a very close and intimate relationship with Anwar Sadat. And you can see there from that clip, you can see what Mr. Armstrong thought about this one man's courage and commitment to peace. I mean, what could the United States have accomplished if it wasn't for Sadat's willingness to go it alone and to change his heart? We've seen decades of what it's like for the United States to get in there and to try to bring two sides together when the two sides won't budge, or one side in particular that wants to obliterate the state of Israel. And how much can you accomplish when you have that kind of position that you're working with? Sadat was right when he said it in 1979, 39 years ago today. What a unique moment. What a historic moment this is. I mean, this is a happy day for me. It's one of the happiest days of my life, he said. It's a pretty incredible story. The sacrifice that that man made in pursuit of peace. My father, in that 2012 Key of David program, listen again to what he had to say there. This is clip 17.
Mr. Armstrong called it the most incredible peace overture of modern times, and frankly, the only one, he also said. After four bitter wars against Israel in 30 years, President Anwar el-Sadat did an unheard-of thing. On November 20, 1977, he declared peace, not war, at extreme personal danger and unprecedented political risk. The Egyptian president braved a personal visit to Jerusalem to speak in peace to the Israeli Knesset. It was the most sensational overture toward international peace made by any head of state in our time.
It's a pretty amazing statement. That program, by the way, is based upon this booklet that I want to draw your attention to today. The Way of Peace Restored Momentarily. Now, we know peace is coming to this earth. We know that peace is about to be established on this earth. And the exciting thing, the inspiring thing about this little booklet is you get a little tiny glimpse into what it's going to take to bring peace to nations. It's going to take a change of heart. If you look at what, and again, this happened just on a national level. I'm not saying Anwar Sadat was converted, and neither does my father in that booklet, but on a national level, he had to change his attitude. And the Israelis were shocked. The Israelis couldn't believe it. There's a prophecy in Ezekiel 36. Verse 26, God says, "A new heart also will I give you, and a new spirit will I put within you, and I'll take away the stony heart out of your flesh, and I'll give you a heart of flesh." God's going to take away that hard-headed stubbornness in the wonderful world tomorrow. He's going to take it away. It says in verse 27 of that same chapter, and I'll put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes, and you shall keep my judgments and do them. I mean, here was the leader of the Arab world leading the way to destroy Israel for 30 years, even as recently as 5 or 6 years, well, 4 years, before he reached out to Israel and says, they're going to be shocked to hear me say this, but I want to go to their house. I want to go to their place. I want to go speak before their parliament and tell them I sincerely seek peace. I have had a change of heart. I'm thinking about my children and grandchildren. I want to lay down my weapons. I want to reach out to my enemy. I want to tell my enemy that I love them. You don't see this in the world today. That's what makes this history, this example, and it's only from 39 years ago. That's what makes it so remarkable, because it's so unusual in this world today. You do not see it. What do you see? Well, I'll have to save some of this for tomorrow's program. There's plenty left over here. But what I can tell you is that you don't see what you saw there in 1977 and 1978 and 1979. Mr. Armstrong had his first meeting with Anwar Sadat in 1974. I mean, this would have been just a year after the Yom Kippur War. Just a year after Egypt led the way, trying to wipe out Israel. But following that war in 73, somewhere along the way, his heart began to change. And maybe it was as soon as he met Herbert Armstrong for the first time. Mr. Armstrong wrote about it, saying, Saturday night, President Anwar Sadat was making a major speech to the nation. He was speaking at the Student Union Building of the Alexandria University. Apparently, it says later, talks about, you know, Mr. Armstrong walking into the room of this gathering of top officials from Egypt's government. And this was at a time when Mr. Armstrong was traveling around the world as an ambassador for world peace, an unofficial ambassador. Mr. Armstrong says, apparently the whole ceremony in this room was arranged for me, though I knew nothing about it. As soon as they were all seated, an official motioned for me to enter, and then I realized I was to walk forward down the center red carpet and be presented to the president. He and his wife rose. Smilingly, the president extended his hand to me. Your Excellency, I said, I'm happy and honored to meet you. I was then presented to the First Lady. I said, I have a personal message for you from His Imperial Highness, Prince Mikasa of Japan, who is a very good friend of mine. He asked me to tell you in person that he would like very much to visit your country next January. It says in this coworker letter, the president's face lit up in a happy smile. We should be happy and honored to welcome the prince to Egypt, he said. I'll send him immediately an official invitation. And it says here, finally, this is the first time I have been presented to a head of state in such a formal and ceremonial manner. This is Mr. Armstrong writing. The first time he had been presented in such a formal and ceremonial manner. Before leaving Cairo at the airport, an official government photograph was given us, taken just after Mr. Rader and I had been presented to him, and while he was shaking hands with Mr. Goto. This will appear in The Plain Truth. So this was the beginning of an intimate relationship that would continue until the day of Anwar Sadat's death. And that happened sooner than Mr. Armstrong would have preferred. We'll talk more about that on tomorrow's program. But this meeting that I just read about, it happened not long after the Yom Kippur War ended. And here's Mr. Armstrong, for the first time, being treated almost like a head of state himself. He had never been in an occasion this formal, this ceremonial. Well, he was to have other meetings with Mr. Sadat, even during that critical time in the late 1970s and following the peace pact that Egypt entered into with Israel. It's fascinating history, both in looking at it from a church history standpoint and also just in looking at world history because of how unusual, how remarkable this is. What an example of the way to peace. It happened there just momentarily back in 1979 on this day, March 26th, 39 years ago. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to send in some comments or give us some feedback, you're welcome to do so by writing to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.